Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Poets' Corner in Westminster Abbey for the second in our series of four lectures entitled Excellent Women, where we're examining the work of four Anglican women novelists. It's my pleasure tonight to welcome as our lecturer Dr. Jessica Martin, now based at Ely Cathedral, where she's responsible for education and outreach and everything else, I think, but in a prior life had been a fellow of Trinity College, Cambridge, where she lectured in English literature. So we're in very good hands this evening as we consider the work of Dorothy L. Sayers, I think particularly her novels we're going to concentrate on tonight, the novels of Dorothy L. Sayers. The reason for having the lectures here in Poets' Corner is because there are remarkably few women who are memorialised here, and people like me are just making a little pitch to see whether we might improve the situation. We have got Jane Austen and the Bronte sisters just here, but they're the tiniest memorials stuck under the great big ones to all the men. So I'm quite sure that tonight's lecture will provoke more consideration about the role and importance of Dorothy Sayers in, at least in 20th century, English literature. There will be time for some questions afterwards, so over to Jessica now, as we look forward to what you have to say to us. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed for your welcome. This is, in fact, the first time I've ever been inside Westminster Abbey, so it's very thrilling. Do carry on. Have something to drink. It's a poor heart that never rejoices. And begin right at the beginning, if you will, please. I have a very trivial mind. Detail delights me. Ramifications enchant me. Distance no object, no reasonable offer refused. The person talking is, of course, Lord Peter Whimsey, the Lord Detective of Dorothy L. Sayers' detective novels. And this is near the beginning of a very early novel, Unnatural Death, which was published in 1927. And he's getting the info for a case he's going to investigate. But we learn quite a lot about what he's like as well. All those rather mercurial shifts of register and of focus, and the way he dances affably round his audience, firing off proverbs and little cliched sayings, being quite chatty, being really pretty bossy, frivolous, dominating the conversation, but with very serious intention. So he's concentrating on the trivia. He says that he has a trivial mind because detail delights him. But that's because he's interested in their ramifications. He's going to deduce from detail something about the larger picture. He's going to sort out the messy problems of human behaviour in an orderly manner by looking at the detail. So this is the detective narrative offered, if you'll excuse the technical term, as a kind of synecdoche. That's the figure of speech where the part both stands for and reveals the meaning of the whole. And I would suggest that Lord Peter's voice sounds a little bit like that of his creator, Dorothy L. Sayers. He's neat and he's orderly. But he's also unpredictable and exuberant. He's very logical. He knows how to build up something from the analysis of detail, but there's that extra sense of a life-giving something which evades all the logic in the world. And at the heart of Sayers' power as a writer, both as a theologian and as a novelist, is this rather unlikely partnership in her life between being quite subversive, quite liberated, quite inclined to spill over the confines of where she is or what she's doing, and this extremely logical, disciplined, beautifully ordered thinking. She's got both. Dorothy L. Sayers was born into an Anglican household in 1893, and she was the only daughter of the Reverend Henry Sayers and his wife Helen, and she grew up in Bluntisham in Cambridgeshire in a rather beautiful rectory there. And her career was one of contrasts and unpredictability. She was a scholar of Somerville College in Oxford, but she was also an unmarried mother. She was a maker of advertising slogans, yet also a theologian, a dramatist, and a fine translator of Dante. She was a faithful Anglican, and she was also a best-selling novelist. She is best remembered for her detective fiction and for the insouciant Lord Peter Wimsey, the main protagonist. And all those novels are written in the interwar period between 1923 and 1938. And they've got that between the wars feel. And in fact, the later ones, you can see the shadow of the war that is coming really very strongly, particularly, I think, in Gaudy Night. And I'll talk a little bit about that later, her most ambitious and one of her last detective novels. In the mid-1930s, she moved towards religious drama, and she'd always loved the theatre and was an enthusiastic participator in amateur dramatics. She wrote a play called The Zeal of Thy House, which was staged at Canterbury Cathedral in 1937. This was the second in an innovative series of sacred drama, and the first had been by one T.S. Eliot and was called Murder in the Cathedral. So, no pressure. She then became a highly influential and pretty reluctant writer in Christian apologetics. And the finest example, I think, is her book, The Mind of the Maker, which comes out in 1941 and is an account of the dynamic nature of the Trinity using the artist's creative process as its governing metaphor for how the different persons of the Trinity interrelate but are distinct. Early in the Second World War, she produced a pretty idiosyncratic set of recommendations for what post-war civic virtue might look like from a Christian standpoint, which is called Begin Here. I think she must have written it in about 5 minutes. It's very energetic and characteristic, but not always thought through. But the peak of her explicitly religious imaginative work was her series of plays for radio based on the life of Christ, The Man Born to be King, which were broadcast between autumn 1941 and spring 1942. And alas, the broadcasts are lost. It is such a shame. It would have been wonderful to hear those that first performance of those plays. They permanently changed imaginative perceptions of the life of Christ, and they were extremely controversial because of her decision to use ordinary colloquial English as her main dramatic medium. So she has quotations in the authorised version from the Gospel of John as the narrator, but everyone else speaks in a very ordinary way, and this fluttered the dovecots considerably. The last 14 years of her life, she concentrated on making a fine translation of Dante's Divine Comedy into English. It was left unfinished at her death, with part of the Paradiso still to do. And she died just before Christmas in 1957. Now, that's a huge range of possible things I might talk about, a huge range of different kinds of achievement, but I'm just actually going to talk about her novels and not about all of them. Specifically, I want to think about Murder Must Advertise, The Nine Tailors, Gaudy Night, Strong Poison, and I'll look a little bit at that very early novel, Unnatural Death. Not because I don't think the others are good, but because the things that I want to say are best illustrated through those novels, which are some of the finest, I think, of her detective novels. And I want to think about what makes them more than just fun detective fiction. And I think this has to do with the way that she's incredibly open to what cannot be grasped or fully known, to those haunting moments when one's lifted beyond the mechanics of her very beautiful constructions and are caught and held by an order that she hasn't perhaps quite intended or is quite in control of. So I want to think about the limitations of the detective genre and how Sayers' unease with these limitations actually takes her right to the edge of what you can do with a detective novel, till the last couple of them are not really just detective novels at all. They're trying to do something else as well. And about her unease with narrative structures which have to be about neat justice as she gets more and more interested in the wilder power of mercy. She doesn't really explore this fully until she starts to write the radio plays about Christ, who is a criminal and a just man and God himself, pardoning as he suffers an unjust punishment and freeing humanity from this cycle of trespass and punishment. And of course, the detective novel is all about trespass and punishment. So I think she almost escapes from her own success in a particular genre. Because detective fiction is all about control. And she knew about control and she could really do it. She is so disciplined about how she writes. It's a very elegant style that she has. Detective novels are about re-establishing order when things have gone awry, about logic and deduction in the pursuit of a transgressor. It attracts the puzzle solver, the restorer of balance. In detective novels, forgiveness is a nuisance because it's structurally redundant. In fact, it even gets in the way. You restore harmony in a detective novel through the rule of law, one way or another, rather than in the exercise of mercy. So in that sense, it's a bit of a more of an Old Testament than a New Testament world. Justice and judgment work together, and law is the means to establish right living. And often in these interwar detective novels, the whole of civil society is represented in some smaller version, so a village or a country house or a ship or a school or a train or even just a closed room. Order is reached by identifying the corrupt individual who's going to be very hard to see because he or she looks just like everybody else. And then once you get that person, you expel them from the civic body. And of course, handily, from this point of view, you're living in an age of capital punishment, so you don't have to worry about what happens to them afterwards. You know what's going to happen to them afterwards. They're going to be executed. So you don't have to think about rehabilitation. You don't have to think about what kind of continuing life they could have beyond the point of their condemnation, because your murderer's gone. You can just dispatch them. And the hangman is a potent nemesis, though, of course, dangerously vulnerable to miscarriages of justice or failures of detection. So the stakes can be kept very high if the wrong person has been accused. And you can see Sayers responding to how orderly this world is, but because she's extremely morally intelligent, she has a problem with it as well. So in her novels, you find that human justice is often inadequate to its task. There is some intervening power that's beyond merely human judgment. And I want to suggest to you that her plots have an invisible protagonist, and his name is Jehovah. So I've got to kind of argue this point, because of course he is invisible and he doesn't have anything to say, but bear with me. And I'm going to start with Murder Must Advertise, which came out in 1933 and is set in an advertising agency realistically similar to the one where Dorothy L. Sayers worked as a copywriter. And the plot is a funny mixture, because some of it is a naturalistic and very funny and entertaining rendition of what it's like to work in a copywriting agency in the late 20s and early 30s. And some of it's a kind of standard-issue, dastardly, drug-running melodrama. And they fit together very oddly, these two bits. And Lord Peter Wimsey is working there, undercover, under the symbolically charged alias of Mr. Death Breeden, which are his two middle names. And Sayers plays with this relationship between the hedonistic world of cocaine-fueled, bright young things partying on the one hand, and the neat, bourgeois, slickly solid invitations of advertising copy on the other, each beckoning in their different ways towards excess, but in these very different settings. Sayers admitted that she didn't know an awful lot about cocaine-fueled partying, and these bits have a sort of kind of dreamlike unreality, which I think has little to do with the drugs and much more to do with the fact that she had no idea what went on. But the plot turns on a kind of eerie equivalence between the drug pushing that's being done through the agency without its knowledge and the advertisement of a patent over-the-counter medicine called Nutrax for Nerves. And Nutrax for Nerves is a kind of front-runner for this morally ambivalent vision of advertising as a process for corrupting the will, for corrupting your ability to make a good decision in the name of pleasure. So it's kind of a morality tale, though a fun one. And you read it thinking that it's like a realistic novel. You know, the style seems very naturalistic. The people talk in, you know, given that they're talking in kind of 1920s, 1930s sort of English, in a very realistic way. But then when you look again, it's full of these kind of set pieces. It borrows theatrical techniques. It's got masks, it's got twins, it's got disguises, it's got ghostly messengers. And although they're all not real, they are very effective. They're kind of, they create an uncanny atmosphere. So you can see Wimsey as a sort of angel of judgment called Death. And he switches between different personae. He's meant to be his own twin, and he's constantly dressing up in different costumes. And at one point, he appears to be having a conversation with himself in a way that nobody could possibly believe for a moment. But you're just swept along by the energy of it, and you believe it's true. Death arrives at the beginning of the story on the back of the first murder. And when he leaves, it's on the back of a pretty unlikely wedding. So, you know, this is beginning to sound like, I don't know, like Shakespeare, like a Shakespeare comedy or a medieval morality play mixed together or a revenge drama. She'll just shove anything in if it works. People's names are not just names. They all mean something. It's not just Wimsey being called Death. So, for example, our main bright young thing, who is the catalyst for the murder and who hangs out with Wimsey in the woods and is terrified and is eventually found with her throat cut, is called Diane de Momery. So Diane, the chaste and remorseless huntress goddess, de Momery, because the word Momery means disguise or dissimulation. So it's, you're being told something about what she stands for. And there's an intelligent, dispassionate colleague of Wimsey's who's not a million miles from Dorothy L. Sayers herself in the way that she's being portrayed, and she's called Miss Meatyard. And the word meatyard you will find in the Book of Leviticus, and it means a measure for judgment. And she is the person who challenges Wimsey and says, you're the interferer, and you think you're doing it for moral reasons, but are you? And I'm the person who stands back and watches, and I think I'm doing it for moral reasons, but am I? So she makes them think, makes us think, about what it means to pursue murderers and whether it's a good idea. And the murderer himself, I'm sorry, I hope this isn't a spoiler, I feel the books have been out for a while. The murderer himself is called Mr. Tallboy, He's a jumped-up minor public schoolboy with aspirations to wealth and gracious living, but actually, he's not all he seems to be. And his name, Tallboy, well, it means a hopelessly bourgeois item of furniture, a large chest of drawers, but it also implies someone at the same time grown up, but also deeply immature, a tall boy. And he does the murder, by the way, with a child's catapult that he steals. So the effect is a bit strange, because you get this realistic, witty setting, and then these symbolic, almost pageant-like effects of different, older literary genres. And in places, it does feel kind of like a revenge tragedy, with Whimsy as the revenger, dressed in a harlequin mask and saying, "I've come to bring justice, I've come to bring death." And the divine justice he's bringing is hovering a bit uncomfortably between Jehovah and Jove. Sayers wrote about Murder Must Advertise some years later, and this is what she said. She called it a contrast of two cardboard worlds, equally fictitious, the world of advertising and the world of the post-war bright young people. And then she repeated a comment that a reader had made about it. "Yes, and Peter Whimsy, who represents reality, never appears in either world except in disguise." It was perfectly true, writes Sayers, and I had never noticed it. It issued without my conscious connivance in a true symbolism. And actually, that symbolism goes well beyond Whimsy's disguise. Just about everything in it is about the relationship that disguise has got with greed and with desire. So the orgiastic parties are fancy dress with masks, of course. The promises of advertising are that buying a given product will make you richer, more successful, or more beautiful than you really are. The copywriters divide into sort of Oxford patrician types and lower middle class toilers, and they have uncomfortable conversations with each other which ponder but don't bridge that gap between the effortlessly entitled and the anxiously aspirational. And the murderer is someone who's trying to go across the gap and who appears to be a virtuous family man with a passion for cricket and stockbroking interests, but is in fact this adulterous drug dealer's cat's paw who has not really quite made it into the top drawer. Like all her really good detective novels, whodunits not that important in Murder Must Advertise. The book's much more focused on the parallels between advertising and drug pushing. So at one point, Chief Inspector Parker, who's the man from Scotland Yard investigating, quotes the Gospel of Luke. "Fear not him that killeth, but him that hath power to cast into hell." And what he's saying is, it's better to be a murderer than to be a drug pusher. And actually, they are used, not in quite that context, but in the context of thinking about greed, by the reformer Hugh Latimer in a sermon called On Covetousness. And we can just about believe that Chief Inspector Parker might have read Latimer, because we know he reads commentaries on the Epistles of St. Paul in his spare time, which is perhaps less usual in chief inspectors now than it was then. And we get some thoughts about the limits of the neat justice system. So at one point, Chief Inspector Parker and Whimsy are agreeing that police work, that, you know, if they find out who's doing the murder and if they do something about this particular set of drug pushers, it's not actually going to do much good. It's not going to redeem anything much, although it's necessary. And Whimsy suddenly quotes a bit of Browning. "'Tis the last judgment's fire must cure this place, calcine its clods and set its prisoners free." And his remark is adapted from Browning's Child Roland to the Dark Tower Came, and you've got the stanza that he's quoting on your handout. And it's kind of suggestive when you go and look at that stanza. "No, penury, inertness, and grimace in some strange sort were the land's portion. See or shut your eyes, said nature peevishly. It nothing skills. I cannot help my case. 'Tis the last judgment's fire must cure this place, calcine its clods and set my prisoners free. So is this about the posturing poverty of the addict or the posturing poverty of the consumer? How different are they? Of course, the two worlds are not completely equivalent. So the way she does the world of drug running is, melodramatic, I think is probably the best way to put it. Whereas the depiction of the advertising agency is quite a lot of fun. You get these snatches of quotation, often from Tennyson's, shoved into these absurd sales settings and splendid daft rhymes. A meal begun with Blagg's tomato softens every husband's heart, oh. And she's got two sections which have these kind of towers of slogans, and they appear twice, once close to the beginning and once as its final statement. And they are about, I mean, she's enjoying changes of register because that's what she loves and that's what she's always doing. But she's also showing how copy distorts the nature of desire. And here's part of the earlier one, and you've got it again on your handout. The presses, thundering and growling, ground out the same appeals by the minion. Ask your grocer, ask your doctor, ask the man who's tried it. Mothers, give it to your children. Housewives, save money. Husbands, insure your lives. Women, do you realise? Don't say soap, say soap-o. Whatever you're doing, stop it and do something else. Whatever you're buying, pause and buy something different. Be hectored into health and prosperity. Never let up. Never go to sleep. Never be satisfied. If once you are satisfied, all our wheels will run down. Keep going. And if you can't, try new tracks for nerves. At the end, once the murderer has himself been murdered by the drug runners and death has departed from Pym's publicity, we get the final paragraph of the book. And again, it's advertising slogans, but in it comes a declaration of a rather different kind. Tell England, tell the world, eat more oats, take care of your complexion. No more war. Shine your shoes with Shino. Ask your grocer. Children love Lax-a-Malt. Prepare to meet thy God. So, although the book is playful and at times downright farcical, beginning to end, I would say it is presided over something above and beyond the reach of detective or policeman or any human power. The judgment of God is very strong in it. She was writing Murder Must Advertise at the same time as another book, The Nine Tailors. In fact, she started The Nine Tailors first, and then she got stuck because she had to find out about bell ringing. So she finished Murder Must Advertise, and then she went back to The Nine Tailors, and it appeared in the following year, 1934. And I think that The Nine Tailors is the perfect form of a divine judgment plot. And therefore, I feel it is pretty much the perfect detective novel, though it doesn't have a murderer, actually. But hey, that's all right. It does have a murder, kind of. So a mysterious body is found buried in a Fenland churchyard, and it's mutilated and it's unrecognisable, and apparently the victim of a savage murder. And as the book unfolds, this death is revealed not to be exactly a murder at all. It's something much stranger, much harder to categorise. There are other deaths as the book goes on, and some of them are savage murders, actually, but we're not so interested in those. And there are acts of malice and acts of generosity which seem to have no consequences to begin with. But in the end, the book's moral logic is governed by the way various characters are implicated in that central, mysterious death, which, as it happens, is the death of a thoroughly bad man. And it's about the workings of Jehovah. And he works through inanimate instruments, unwitting actions, coincidence, and just downright carelessness. The Cambridgeshire Fen Country itself, inhospitable, unpredictable, liable to flood and to revert to its original sea and marsh, is both the book's starkly vivid setting, but also one of its plot movers. Floods and unreliable weather get quite a lot of different things going in this book. And the church of Fenchurch St. Paul, its soul pent in those uncanny and enigmatic speakers, its bells, is also a character. It's an amalgam of a number of different Fen churches with a touch of Holy Trinity Blither in Suffolk as well, because it's got a marvellous angel roof and various other... I think she just put in all the things she liked, shoved them all into this imaginary church. Its village is a world within a world where the Lord Protector Cromwell lives on as a potent political force that's constantly being invoked. It's cut off by weather and by culture from the softer, though not less treacherous, landscapes of London and post-Great War Normandy. And Lord Peter stumbles into that world by what men call chance, as one person in the book puts it, when his car crashes on a dangerous corner in filthy weather. And the scene's set. He's going to meet the main characters, he's going to be told the backstory, which is about the theft of some valuable emeralds, and set a few puzzles, all in the first 20 pages. So the book is organised round bell ringing, and although Dorothy L. Sayers was not herself a ringer, her father was an enthusiastic ringer, and she spent quite a lot of time and care on the theoretical mastery of the mathematics of bell ringing. And if you've ever tried to bell ring, you will know that the mathematics is exceedingly complicated. And if you're a musician, you'll know that it is worse than useless to use your ears. You have to be able to count. So bell ringing is the book's governing metaphor, and each chapter is named for a bell ringing technique with always a punning second meaning which tells the reader about the plot. Lord Peter is called into the hunt, the slow work, the dodging. This is the language of bell ringing, but not the language of the bells. The bells speak without words. They speak in the mathematical patterning of a peal, in responsive humming or brazen clanging. They denote the many deaths of a damp, poor 1920s Fen village, babies, the old, the weak, the ill, when they ring the nine tailors as the passing bell for a man is called. It's really noticeable in the book how often the rector is called off to yet another dying, yet another deathbed, and all the way from babies to the old, with all ages in between. They speak through their inscriptions, and they speak through old stories. One of the suspects says, "Oh, those bells, I was expecting all the time to hear them speak. I never have liked the sound of bells. When I was a boy, I read a story in a magazine about a bell that called after a murderer, 'Help, Jehan! Help, Jehan!'" It is the bells, and again, I don't feel this is a spoiler. I'm hoping that you've read the books, or that if you haven't, you'll be reading them for something other than the plot devices. It's the bells which are revealed as the killers, because the man is shut in a bell-ringing chamber, above the bell-ringing chamber, on a snowy night when they ring a 9 hours peal, and he's just kind of killed by the sheer sound. He dies of a stroke, essentially, which was in the 17th century called a blow from above and associated with divine vengeance. Sense and nonsense, deduction and coincidence all pattern themselves together. A key clue presents as a dreamlike piece of visionary writing. And there's a cipher that is a numerical bell-ringing cipher, which the rector identifies because his spectacles are off and he mistakes what he's seeing. And then they find that this cipher is three phrases from the Psalms that reveal the location of the stolen emeralds in the roof beams of the church. So the part in words doesn't make any sense. The part in numbers reveals the sense, and then that double sense shows us the part of the church and locates the presence of God at the same time. He sitteth between the cherubims. The isles may be glad thereof. We get other verbal clues from a parrot and from a simpleton called Potty Peak, who's not sure what is and what is not real and is obsessed with hanging. So his testimony is not all that reliable, but actually he tells a truth that nobody can hear. If you knowed what Potty knows, I've seen him, number 9. But the tailor's was too much for him. Him with the rope, he got him, and he'll get you too. Potty knows. Potty ain't lived all these years in and out of the church for nothing. And the parrot mutters excitedly, must go to church, must go to church. The bells, don't tell Mary. Then there's this exchange between Superintendent Blundell, who's the local guy investigating, Chief Inspector Parker again, and Whimsy. And it unravels the whole mystery, but we don't know as we read it that it has. They say it, but they don't understand what they're saying. And that's this little bit over the page. Whoever's got the emeralds did the murder. I'm sure of that. Where thy treasure is, there shall thy heart be also, said Whimsy. The heart of this crime is down in St. Paul. That's my prophecy, Charles. Will you have a bet on it? Nope, I won't, said the chief inspector. You're right too often, Peter, and I've no money to waste. And Whimsy's just told us exactly what has happened. The emeralds are in the church. The church did the murder, or rather the bells of the church did the murder. But we don't see it. And it's all kind of shown in that little quotation from the Gospel of Matthew. Where thy treasure is, there thy heart shall be also. Another example. So the lock gates to the local drainage canal haven't been properly serviced, and there's a cataclysmic flood with which the book closes. It looks like chance, but actually it's a plot mover. The Lord sitteth above the water flood. The church turns into an ark of safety because it's on high ground, and the rector, who is a loving portrait of Sayre's own absent-minded but dedicated father, proves to be a strong tower of safety for all under his cure. The flood kills 2 men, and one of them, Will Foday, is drowned trying to save the other one. He's not actually a murderer, but he is fatally compromised by the events of the plot, so that it's his death comes across like a sort of natural end, but also the expiation for his morally compromised position. And the flood chapter has got an epigraph from Psalm 42. All thy waves and thy billows are gone over me. And that's a psalm which uses the idea of flood in a metaphorical way to mean profound mental distress. At the end of the whole novel, the rector, who has a bit of a habit of sort of summing up the moral position, speaks for, if you like, the God's eye view of the whole story. And he says, perhaps God speaks through these mouths of inarticulate metal. He is a righteous judge, strong and patient, and is provoked every day. And if that second sentence sounds faintly familiar, it's because it's from Psalm 29. So this is pretty uncompromising stuff. Lots of judgment. What about redemption? Actually, Sayers is really interested in forgiveness, and she wrote verse exploring the possibilities of redemption for Faustus and for Judas. But where is there room in a detective novel for the disorderly exercise of mercy? The answer is there isn't much space for it, not structurally, because mercy means mess. Forgiveness is a different kind of openness to divine intervention, and it just ruins your plot devices, because all that happens is that somebody doesn't behave the way they should. You know, Shakespeare thought about this quite hard, actually. So it won't support civic balance, it won't necessarily expel the transgressor, it may undermine or threaten the rule of law. So once Sayers gets interested in it, her plots get pulled in different ways, and her relationships with human justice systems become quite complicated and sometimes deliberately compromised. And I want to just look at a couple of other novels in relation to the way that this subversive undercutting of the rule of law happens very often through female agency, through women. It's, you know, it's quite a male cast that you have with women in a supporting role in the earlier novels. And then you get the disruptive presence of Harriet Vane, who is eventually going to marry Lord Peter Wimsey and who is, guess what, a detective novelist. But also, I don't want to just think about Harriet, who's quite a problematic example for various reasons, but also the unmarried spinsters who do so much detective work for Lord Peter Wimsey. When you look at some of those books, you realise that Wimsey does almost nothing except sit around spouting and being funny, and all the legwork is done by these unmarried women. And they do it wonderfully, and they take all the risks, and you just don't notice it until you start looking. So these, of course, there were lots of these, of course, in post-First World War England. All these superfluous women who would never marry because all the men had been killed. And the first one I want to look at is Miss Climpson, an elderly high church spinster who appears in several of the Wimsey books. And she's employed by Wimsey as a kind of agent, part of an organisation he calls My Cattery, which gives these superfluous women work exposing fraud and other kinds of criminal or exploitative activity. And Miss Climpson is great. I think she was based on an aunt of Dorothy Sayers's. Totally morally blameless in every respect, completely socially invisible, quite used to the casual contempt of those around her, with a conscience honed by years of Anglo-Catholic spiritual discipline and a sense of what is true and right which definitely exceeds and is prepared to defy ordinary secular expectations of what justice is. So we meet her first in this very early novel, Unnatural Death, where she is deployed to make inquiries on Wimsey's behalf exactly because her spinster status makes her pretty unremarkable. So she does all the action, she does all the legwork in this one. And she has this very distinctive, very comic epistolary voice with lots of underlinings and italics. And you've got an example of one of the things that she says right at the bottom of your handout. And again, I think that was based on the way that this particular aunt wrote her letters. So Unnatural Death is about exposing a crime that might not be a crime. It's completely invisible. An old lady who's going to die anyway dies a bit sooner than people expect, and has she been bumped off or not? And the case troubles Wimsey's conscience because actually, once he gets involved and interferes, he causes some more deaths. And he goes to a vicar to seek spiritual advice, a man called Mr. Treadgold. He doesn't think it's quite enough that there might have been a crime, even though that's what the law would say, because perhaps he's done more harm than good. And Mr. Treadgold says this: the sin lies much more in the harm it does the killer than in anything it can do to the person who is killed. Do what is right. Leave the consequences to God. And remember that if we all got justice, you and I wouldn't escape either. So that's a remarkable piece of advice. I think possibly Mr. Treadgold had been reading Romans chapter 12. It convinces Wimsey to keep going, and a few more people get killed as a result. But that's okay, because it's not about the body, the killing of the body. It's about the safeguarding of the soul. So Wimsey himself sums up his dilemma in Unnatural Death in the much later book, Gaudy Night, which came out in 1935, and this is what he says. I happened to find out that a young woman murdered an old woman for her money. It didn't matter much. The old woman was dying in any case, and the girl, though she didn't know it, would have inherited the money in any case. As soon as I started to meddle, the girl set to work again, killed two innocent people to cover her tracks, and murderously attacked three others, and finally killed herself. If I'd left her alone, there'd only have been one death instead of four. This forms the basis for a conversation that Whimsy then has with a group of women academics in Oxford, and it actually thinks about the ethics of his intervention in terms which just won't go near the idea of sin. It evades that whole concept. So, for example, they wonder whether the further murders come around through the fear of the death penalty. And that's the first time you've heard Sayers be at all worried about the death penalty, actually. Or whether being a murderer is a treatable psychiatric condition. There's lots of stuff in Gaudy Night about how if people took the right vitamins, perhaps they wouldn't be wicked anymore. And this being the mid-1930s, whether there might be a eugenic solution to transgressive behaviour. Because the book's being written in 1935, eugenics has not yet got the name that it acquires after we discover what's been happening in Germany. But it is something that's being thought about and talked about all the time. So when you read Gaudy Night, you find some perfectly honourable and harmless people suggesting the most horrifying solutions to criminality. Or indeed to various kinds of disability. And you kind of think, oh my goodness, this is definitely before Hitler's just transforms the landscape morally about what you should or shouldn't do to people. So eventually, in this conversation, they arrive at the idea that the victims died for the people sacrificed to a social principle. And they further establish that principles always bring about violence, but that not having principles means that you get violence without any of the social fringe benefits, if you like. And then Whimsy adds, apparently casually, that had the murderer survived, she would have been incidentally corrupting one or two people's minds if you think that's of any importance. And I think for Dorothy Sayers, that's of really huge importance. And unnatural death is all about the effect of corrupting people's minds and thinks of it as a serious sin. So Miss Climpson, who knows all about the twists and turns of women's relationships with each other, sees the murderess as dominating this much younger woman who's in love with her. And she thinks the relationship's unhealthy, not because it's a relationship between two women, because actually elsewhere in the book, a lifelong relationship between two women is seen as the absolute pinnacle of a perfect relationship, but because the power relations are unequal. She calls it damnable selfishness wearying of its victim. And she discovers that the younger woman, of course, has been pressurized into lying for the older one, and an alibi rests on this lie. And she works this out because she goes into this Anglo-Catholic church and finds the scribbled notes of the younger woman who's made her confession. And they include, you know, that I told lies for this other person's sake. So she decides she'll confront the murderer, and she's nearly murdered herself, and so on and so forth. The younger woman is murdered, but in the logic of Mr. Treadgold's theology, because she dies innocent, she is in a better case than the murderer who kills herself, but is unrepentant. We see Miss Climpson yet next in Strong Poison, which came out in 1930, and that's the novel that introduces Sayers' other major protagonist, Harriet Vane, who appears as a suspect, trapped by a chain of evidence which, you know, looks unbreakable and points to her as the murderer, but of course we know she's completely innocent. And we first see her being tried for her life, and Miss Climpson's on the jury. And Miss Climpson just refuses to accept the evidence. And she does it by arguing that Harriet Vane doesn't look like a murderer and that the prisoner's demeanour is part of the evidence and she's entitled to take it into account. And then she brings with her another woman who thinks nothing of men and takes a dislike to the foreman. And as a result, the trial has to be deferred, and that gives Whimsy his month in which to save her life by finding out who really did it. And as the barrister for the defence says dryly, a person who can believe all the articles of the Christian faith isn't going to boggle over a trifle of adverse evidence. We sweat like hell to prepare evidence. Then one person makes up her mind on what isn't really evidence at all, and another supports her on the grounds that evidence can't be relied on. So the barrister sees it as irrational femininity breaking into the deductive process. And, you know, he is right. But because of it, the truth has a chance to prevail, because actually the evidence is wrong. Now, Sayers does have a bit of a structural problem in Strong Poison, because Harriet Vane's in prison for the whole book, which forces her to be passive. And in order to develop Harriet's relationship with Whimsy, Whimsy also needs to be fairly static. So if you read the book, you notice that Whimsy does just about nothing at all, and Miss Climpson does everything. So she goes down to get the will of a senile old woman, and a friend of hers, Miss Murchison, has to break into a strongbox for which she has to have the assistance of a reformed safebreaker turned born-again preacher, and she spends an instructive evening singing revivalist choruses and learning how to use a picklock. Miss Climpson masquerades as a spiritualist because she's learnt all the tricks. She knows about how to squeeze the soapbox between your knees to produce cracks and what sort of pure trickery she can use to really gull the senile old woman's nurse into giving her access to the will. And it works. And so, again, although it's all completely explicable, actually the solution to Harriet Vane's problem lies in a series of apparently otherworldly messages, which is rather a nice touch, I think. Though, as Miss Climpson observes in her letter to Whimsy, what excuse I can find in my conscience for the methods I've used, I don't know. But I believe the church takes into account the necessity of deception in certain professions, and I trust that my subterfuges may be allowed to come under that category. So the higher justice is served by transgressive female guile, fervour, and spiritual credulousness. A masculine rational deduction stands helplessly by. So, coming towards the end, I want to argue that Dorothy Sayers is almost always resistant to a completely straightforward relationship between the logic of justice and the cause of truth. And actually, she tends to avoid straightforward murders and straightforward punishments. And this evasiveness reaches a peak in Gaudy Night, her novel set in an Oxford women's college, where there's no murder at all. Instead, there's a romantic plot wrapped in an intellectual dilemma about the place of women in the world. And the presenting issue is a bunch of poison pen letters. And in a way, the whole book is more about the corruption of the spirit than about anything which can happen to the body, which I think you'll also find is something that Sayers comes back to over and over again. She talks about it quite a lot in her books written about and within the war, that, you know, the possibility of dying horribly is neither here nor there compared to whether your soul is pure. Which is brave. So Gaudy Night is the nearest we get to a novel that's just escaped from the detective genre altogether and is trying to be something else, which makes it both hugely ambitious, very exciting to read, and in some ways a bit of a mess. Because it's set in the mid-1930s, it's extraordinary how many of its preoccupations are set by Hitler's agenda: eugenics, experiments on criminals and the unfit, the abolition of sin by science, and the place of women in the home are all themes that come up over and over again. When I was 18, I thought it was the most wonderful novel ever, but I have to say its different bits sit together rather uneasily. So it's a romantic denouement, but it's also an examination of the dangerous place of principle in life decisions, and the glue between them comes a bit unstuck from time to time. Again, Sayers doesn't know what to do with Harriet Vane, because if she makes her too interesting, then she'll upstage Whimsy. But if she doesn't make her fairly interesting, how is she going to sort of manage the denouement in a way that's not going to just look like her falling spinelessly into his arms? So she has to sort of maintain a tension between the two of them for as long as she can manage. And she also keeps Whimsy stuck on the continent trying to prevent the Second World War for as much of the book as she can get away with, so that Harriet Vane can actually do a bit of detecting on her own account. But of course she doesn't do it as well as Whimsy does, and Whimsy has to come back and solve the whole thing. But she gives Harriet a place to think hard about what it might be to get married on her own terms, about her independence, her intellectual independence, her physical independence, her financial independence. Whimsy, of course, is fabulously rich. And her place in the world, about what she would die for and what she's prepared to live for, about what kind of sacrifices are worth it. So with hindsight, this does look like a book that's limbering up to a war. And not just because Whimsy's averting it with his ticklish foreign diplomacy. That said, the romantic cadences don't really suit this tougher, more uncompromising set of features. You know, Harriet seems to oscillate between sort of falling into his arms and saying, I can't marry you because I need to be an independent person. And I don't think the two are come together very satisfactorily. The other thing that's not all that satisfactory about it is that when they discover the desperate, of course, female writer of the poison pen letters, obviously she can't be disposed of by a hangman because she hasn't killed anybody. So what do you do with her? She's still alive. So they say, oh, she was medically dealt with. Now, what does that mean? They've been talking about eugenics for, you know, 250 pages, and then suddenly they say she's going to be medically dealt with. I think it sounds downright sinister. So I think Sayers was encountering the outer limits of what the detective novel could bear. And her last full-length novel, Busman's Honeymoon, which is Whimsy and Harriet Vane's honeymoon, began life as a play. And its plot, which balances a completely commonplace murder for a commonplace motive against the moral agony that Whimsy experiences for having meddled in the case, makes the difficulties of a punishment plot very evident. So it ends with this perfectly ordinary young man who's given way to greed, basically, and murdered an old man for his money, being hanged, while Whimsy gets into a complete state about having let it happen. Now, if he'd not interfered, then someone else would probably have been condemned. But that doesn't help him. He's still unable to bear the responsibility, or almost unable to bear the responsibility of having meddled in the way that justice moves inexorably to destroy a person. And I think it's no accident that she then stops writing in the genre altogether. And she moves towards drama, which places the terms of salvation in opposition to the moral accounts that human beings keep on themselves. So The Zeal of Thy House, which she does in Canterbury Cathedral, its main protagonist is this brilliant medieval architect, and his redemption is found not in his skill, but in the fact that he's humbled through physical accident and pain. So his artifact is less important than the responsive nakedness of his soul before God. And I don't think it's any surprise that Sayers spends the last years of her life translating that toughly salvific journey that Dante realizes in the Divine Comedy. The shaping art of making order through punishment was not so much left behind as made subject to a profound sea change. The narrative journey upon which she settles in the end proves not to be one of detection, not one of the move from problem to solution. Instead, It's an act of divine sacrifice in the person of Christ, in the man born to be king, an experience of redemptive change which sidesteps neither pain nor death. The Man of Sorrows play is just extraordinary. But it doesn't even sidestep despair, because we see Judas's despair in it in a way that's also deeply affecting. But the place where it ends is eternal joy. Thank you.
Jessica, thank you very much for a masterly survey of Sayers' novels. Now, we're going to open up for questions. We have a roving mic, so if you have a question or comment that you'd like to throw into the ring, if you don't raise your hand, we'll get the mic to you. There we are.
What terrified me through the whole talk, it was wonderful, was a writer writes to teach. Who was she reaching in the 30s? Who could buy a book?
I don't know very much about the publishing industry in the 30s, but if you look at 30s novels, if you look at the actual sort of physical books themselves, they are extraordinarily cheaply made and they don't cost very much. Their paper is thin, they're dreadfully printed, they're often hardbacks, but they're cloth-backed hardbacks. I think that she was best-selling. I can't give you the print run, but I know that a great many people were reading her. She was published by Gollancz, which was then a relatively new firm, she did pretty well out of the books because they took off in a way that she hadn't expected.
Anyone else?
I'd like to ask, are there any specific writers that Dorothy Sayers was influenced by? And also, can you tell us of any more contemporary literary figures who may have been influenced by her as well? Thank you.
She was very influenced by the canon of great writers that she had read. So I tried to suggest that she was using rather a lot of Shakespeare in a kind of subterranean way, enormously influenced by the Book of Common Prayer and the Authorized Version of the Bible, very directly influenced by G.K. Chesterton, who she hugely admired. And she was one of that generation also who had discovered the metaphysical poets, who were hugely obscure until the 1920s when Eliot discovers John Donne and others, and they become a resource for the spiritually minded who are interested in metaphysics, but who are also interested in the erotics of metaphysics, if you like. She loved Thomas Love Peacock, and Sheridan Le Fanu, who she's always quoting in one way or another. And she really enjoyed various bits of French fiction that I can't remember the names of any of them because I haven't read them myself. I think she's been a very considerable influence on subsequent detective novelists. The obvious example, I guess, is P.D. James, who is another Anglican woman detective novelist of a comparable kind with a comparably tough-minded take on life. I think she also, she did a lot to make the detective genre respected. She was part of, I can't remember what it was called, but there's a detective novelist society that she was part of. The Crime Writers Association, was it perhaps called? The Detection Club. Thank you very much indeed. And I also think she just made the idea that women could be respected writers and theologians a possible idea, that she's one of that generation of people who makes it possible to imagine that you could say something into the public square, both through fiction and directly through apologetics, though she didn't want to be that kind of writer. And she was very, bishops were always writing to her and saying, could you do some more Christian apologetics? And she'd say, no, I'm a novelist, go away. But she still did do some.
Could I say, first of all, how delighted I am to have heard your talk tonight, and I speak on behalf of several members of the Dorothy L. Sayers Society who are sitting in front of you.
Oh, yeah. Splendid.
I think is it working? Yes, it is. One person I think that she was influenced by, I think that you didn't mention, was Wilkie Collins.
Yes. And actually, I cut a little bit out of the talk that said the Moonstone yes. is very, very clearly behind Murder Must Advertise in a palpable way, including that kind of uncanny atmosphere that you get from...
Yes, yeah, yes. And yeah. she did actually write about Wilkie Collins.
She did.
Yes.
You're quite
yeah,
right.
Yes.
Yeah.
So I think that... And I'm absolutely delighted that you took up particularly the cause of Murder Must Advertise, which some people dismiss, I think,
yes.
Compared with Nine Tailors or Gaudy Night, because I think it is a book that has a great deal in it. And actually, you've opened up more of it tonight, so thank you very much.
The more I looked at it, the more it was a tissue of different allusions and little bits of, not necessarily quotation, but pastiche sounds rude, but she'd poured so much of her reading into it, and she'd made the atmosphere through so many different skillful bits of imitation or tribute to different writers that I was amazed by it. It was really hard to stop writing about it, actually.
Right, one, two.
Mine's really short. Where is she buried?
I don't know. Do you know?
Yes, indeed.
In my church.
Her ashes are interred in the tower of St. Anne's Church in Soho, just up the road.
Thank you for a lovely talk. It was fascinating. I think as a general reader, I read her novels primarily for the entertainment value. And it's always incredibly interesting to be made more aware of the depth of the meaning of the allegories and everything. Do you think her contemporary readers, those that read at the time when the books were published, do you think in general that they understood the depth of the meaning? Or did they just read for entertainment?
They're cracking reads, aren't they? You can just kind of romp through them because she's got such a lovely, clean style. There's not a single unnecessary word in any of them. So I think they have the great virtues of being books that can be read on a variety of different levels. They're books you can reread. And they're part of my comfort reading, actually. I will go back to them periodically because I will always find something else. So I think, who can say? I can't speak for how contemporary readers apprehended them, but my guess is that you could read them fast for the surface and have a lovely time, or you could pause and find those depths. And the fact that they have gone on being reprinted, that there have been a variety of different dramatic representations of them, which have been very popular, suggests that there's something more to them than just the ephemera of between the wars detective fiction. So something endures that people recognise, even if they don't know quite what it is they're seeing.
Okay, thank you.
One more and then we'll stop. Thank you.
What do you think she was actually saying to the reader at that time in the 30s about the relationship between men and women, but particularly the role of women? Because I remember struggling with the dilemma of loving Peter Wimsey when I was young and reading it, and then getting really, you know, really thinking about Harriet Vane and whether she wanted to marry him or not. And I was thinking, I don't know, you know, she's, and all the other women, you know, they've got their own individual lives. Why should they, you know, they ought to get on with it. What do you think she was saying to people about it?
She didn't solve it in her own life, really. Although she was very gallant about how she dealt with various disappointments and not wholly satisfactory men. There's a moment in Gaudy Night which I absolutely loved when I was reading it as a teenager, where she's talking with Miss Devine. Miss Devine said, and she says, how will we know what things are of overmastering importance? And Miss Devine says to her, we will only find that out when they have overmastered us. And I thought, oh, that's so wonderful. You know, it's just the sort of thing you think when you're 17. That's how I'll find out, because I'll be just overwhelmed by it, whatever it is, and then I won't have to make a choice. But actually, that is, I think, the point of cop-out, in a way. She makes Peter Wimsey increasingly ideal as a mate. You know, he's very thoughtful. He understands her dilemma better than she does all the time. He allows her space. He allows her to continue as a detective novelist. He allows her to keep her own money. He doesn't overwhelm her with presents. You know, I mean, he couldn't be. And of course, he's a marvelous lover. So, what's to complain about? But on the other hand, once you start reading Busman's Honeymoon and you realise what the reality is of actually marrying into this landed family that's extraordinarily wealthy, and what it will in reality mean for her, and there's that rather unsatisfactory short story with the children, where she you can see her being quite happy about the estate being entailed, and so any daughters being kind of cut out of the inheritance, and you think, I don't know quite how I feel about this. So I don't think, I think she once said that she wrote whenever she was feeling unhappy about her own life, she gave Peter Wimsey something that she'd quite like. So if she was living in a grotty place, she'd give him an Aubusson carpet, or, you know, if she was eating horrible food, she would give him a marvellous dinner. And I think there's an element of Harriet Vane being the person who is her, who is getting the thing she never had, which is this impossible man. And it's very, that's what's so powerful about the romantic story, but you sort of end it and you think, oh, that's so lovely, but...
Jessica, we must let you have a rest and a sit down. Thank you very much indeed. We are much in your debt for a most stimulating and enjoyable evening together. I will certainly go back to Dorothy Sayers to do some rereading of books I haven't read for quite a long time. And particularly, thank you, because I remember, some of you will remember, seeing a television series. Do you remember? A number of the books were televised. Was it in the 80s or 90s or something? and which I don't remember having anything like the subtlety that you have pointed out in terms of the actual text. So thank you very much indeed. And I hope we'll see you back at Westminster Abbey ere long, if I may put it that way. Now you're here. Thank you.